I'm Carl W., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carl.
This is my least favorite thing to do. Small room, small crowd, still nervous as hell. I prayed before I came. I prayed this morning knowing I was going to have to do it. I prayed about it when I was asked to do it, and I could not come up with a single reason that I couldn't do it. Wanted to. I worked during the day, but I went ahead and put that off. So hopefully it won't suck. My sobriety date's December 18th, 1991. So I haven't had a drink in a long time. I can't believe that, because when I first went in, I got sober at the Howe place. And when I first went in there and saw on the board where they had people with like years of sobriety, I just thought, really, I thought y'all were all lying. I looked around and they smoked back then, and everybody's eyes were red. And I'm sure y'all were smoking pot or doing something. There was no way you were going to stay sober for that amount of time. So, and it was just anyway. It's a long time without a drink. I can't believe I got sober that long. I've been sober that long. I can't believe I'm as old as I am. Two things I did not intend on doing. My plan, I guess, when I was drinking, when I had a plan, was I wasn't going to live past 28. You know, I really wasn't. I didn't file taxes until I was 28. I had no intention of doing anything, really, other than just drink and party hard until it was all over. And that was my real plan. It was a terrible plan, and it didn't work well, but it was. So being 51 and being sober 25 years is totally contrary to what I had planned when I set out. When I was drinking so heavy, but I don't know what it was like. You know, I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. Pretty good, you know, really good family. I consider it pretty normal. Been to some counseling, so they don't consider it all that normal. But you know, I guess your whole perception of normal when you're growing up, I guess, is just you know. Seems a lot more normal when you're in it than when you tell somebody about it. But, you know, I had a good raising. I went to a Catholic school for first through eighth grade. That was a good experience. I didn't have any trouble with any of the priests or none of the horrible stories you see in the news. None of that happened. Very good. Had a spiritual experience in the second grade. You go to your first confession, and then you have communion. And, it, you know, first confession is kind of like a four-step. I didn't know I was going to have to do that later on also. You know, it was a great experience. You know, I was very scared to death before I went to see the priest. And I talked to my dad, what's going to happen? He said, you're just going to go in there and talk to him, and when you come out, you're just going to be happy. You're just going to be so happy that you did it. And I went in there, and I talked to that priest, and told him about the scissors I had stolen in kindergarten. Yeah, I started out early at robbery. They always had these things where they wanted to get you to give it back, and they wanted you to make amends. And it's not like you think where you just get the, you know, the Our Father and the Hail Mary and you're done. They made me go actually do stuff. So it kind of made me think twice about what I was going to do. But it was a great experience. I came out of there. I had kind of a bright light spiritual experience. I felt very close to God, very close to Jesus. You know, it just was really very good overall. You know, so I started out good. You know, and I can remember my dad drank a lot, and my mom didn't drink at all. He was a Northern Yankee Catholic, and she was a Southern Baptist from Tennessee. Not supposed to mix. And I don't guess they did real well. They ended up divorced, and they fought a lot, and I just don't guess they did mix. But my dad had a lot of parties. He was a developer and a builder, and he was very... in with the mayor, and the chief of police was his uncle, and just he was kind of a big shot in the town. And I could go in the bars with him, and he'd sit me up on the bar, and no one would say anything. And with the police chief drinking with you, you really couldn't get in much trouble. So everybody in the bar would buy me a soda, and I was just a big shot. You know, I was 6 years old, sitting in the bar with the guys. They'd give me money. I'd go play the pinball machines, and it was just a little kid's dream. You know, my dad was my hero. So growing up, and so I started out in the bars pretty early, And like a 6 year, my mom didn't like that. She would come in there and put a stop to it all and yell at my dad and take me home. She always had a way of finding us, and he'd get in a lot of trouble. And you know, but it was just, for me, it was just exciting. There was nothing wrong with drinking. Everybody on my dad's side was having fun. Our parties were good. The family events were good. All his family was there. My grandparents were there, my cousins. So we'd have 30, 40 relatives showing up at these family events. And just, you know, life was good, you know. We had a lot of stuff. He made really good money. So we just did a lot of playing and riding motorcycles and go-karts. I was pretty spoiled, really, looking back on it. My perspective of things was I grew up on a farm. My brother's perspective of things is we grew up in the suburbs. So I guess my perspective of things was never quite totally right. But we just had a lot of room to run and play, and you know, there wasn't a lot of danger of getting hurt or abducted or a lot of the other stuff that's going on today. And I just had great memories of growing up. I guess my dad quit drinking. Well, he had my first drink was right off the rip, you know, right off the bat there. I guess when I was about 8 years old, my dad had a big party, and everybody was there in the basement, and they were all playing poker, and I was allowed to be down there with them, and it was my job to go get the beer and bring it to them, or go mix their drinks and bring it to them, and I was involved. You know, my other brothers weren't allowed down there. I was allowed down there, so I was the coolest kid, and it was just the best thing ever, you know, and I was able to drink a beer. I don't remember my first drink of water. I definitely remember my first drink of beer. So, came in a little glass, had a little ship's wheel on it, and I can remember everything about it, how it tasted. It was great, just the camaraderie. Everything they talk about in the big book about the, you know, the camaraderie of drinking and all that conviviality, and just, it was great. You know, I loved it. And these guys were dropping money everywhere, and I was picking it up, so I had a ton of money in my pocket, and drinking some beers. I'm 6 years old, or 8 years old, feeling good, one of the guys, and that's really about it. You know, that was my first experience with drinking, and I really, probably not how it should be, really, I don't guess, when you're 8 years old, but anyway, it's how it was, and so that was all good experience. And then my dad quit drinking probably shortly after that. I never thought his drinking was a problem because he was fun. My mom thought his drinking was a big problem. And I guess it was hard on the family, him not coming home sometimes. And, you know, I can remember my other brother, his experiences were much different. I can remember him waiting out front to go to the circus, waiting on my dad, and he never showed up, and my mom being upset, and just, you know, a lot of bad things happening, and them fighting a lot more. And so I guess, you know, I guess he did have a problem with drinking. I don't think he's an alcoholic because he's doing okay today. And he quit drinking for about 15 years. He drinks again now, but he doesn't really drink a whole lot, so I don't know really what that's all about. I guess that's between him and God. Thinking back on that, you know, he quit, and then he didn't drink for, like I said, 15 years. So until I graduated high school, he was sober. And family life was pretty good. It was calm. We did a lot of stuff together. You know, mom was there, dad was there. We were going to the school, learning stuff, learning about God, and everything was pretty normal, you know. Then probably about 6th or 7th grade, I guess one of the neighbor kids, drugs were a part of my story a little bit. A big bit, really. I'm alcoholic through and through. Alcohol was always been my drug of choice. I loved it since I saw it. But one of the neighbor kids decided to grow some pot plants. So he had some seeds, so I decided to grow some pot plants. And we planted them in the garden, and my parents knew I was doing it, and they thought it was funny. And so I grew this thing, and it grew like 8 foot tall. My grandfather was fertilizing this garden. He didn't know what it was. He thought it was a vegetable. This thing got huge. The chief of police, my uncle, came up by and said, "You got to take that down. We can't have that there." And so they took it down, and I sold a little bit off of it and dried it out. And we used to go on these family walks, and maybe once a year. Well, of course we went when I had all that stuff laying out there drying in the field. And so we went out to walk, and sure as shit, there it was, and got in a little trouble. I tried smoking it for the first time, and nothing. It was just, it wasn't really a very good plant. It was just something to talk about. And but I kept at it, and I did find some pot that was good, and I liked that a lot. And probably drank. It was okay to drink in my family when you were 14 at the family events. And so I would drink, you know, with my cousins in the basement, and all the adults would be upstairs drinking, and we were only allowed to have two. So whenever I was asked whether I had, I don't think I probably ever had more than four, but I was always on number two, and it stayed that way through my whole drinking career. I was always on number two, if ever asked. The police asked me how many beers I had when I was driving, two. You know, it's a very good, easy number to remember, even drunk. So, but couldn't walk, but I'd only had two beers. But, you know, it was just still good memories. I started smoking pot. I started selling pot in school. I went to this Catholic school, and I'm sitting in there, and I put the little joints and the markers, and I was selling markers in class. And the nun was grabbed the markers, was up front, telling it. I thought I was in trouble. She was telling the class what a great entrepreneur I was. And how everyone should follow my example. There was a few kids in the class that knew what was in the markers, and I was hoping to God they didn't speak up, but they didn't, and I was a hero, and just right away living this double life, and I loved that. I mean, getting away with that kind of stuff, because I got in trouble a lot, got in a lot of fights. I was short, redheaded. I knocked my front teeth out early, chasing a girl, knocked my front teeth out. You know, I guess that started early, too. So I got picked on a lot, so I learned to fight. I fought a lot. So, you know, that was, Catholic school was still pretty good. The teachers there took an interest in me and got me from hanging out with the bad kids that were doing all the bad stuff, and got a bunch of the good kids together that were doing well in life, and got me with them and had them kind of intervene on me and try to get me on the right track. And usually you would rebel against that, I guess, or I would, but for some reason I took it to heart, I guess, and I just started hanging out with the kids that were doing well, you know, and it pretty much changed everything. I stopped smoking pot, I didn't drink very much at all. I came up with a plan. I was going to go to, you know, I was going to become an Air Force pilot. I started getting very good grades. I went on into high school. I was getting, my first year of high school, I got straight A's. I was taking all the honor students, and I was, all the honor classes, and I was doing just really well. And then one of the kids at high school said, I had this big bottle of pills. I also took guitar class, and evidently that's where all the potheads hang out. So he had this bottle of pills, and he was selling them. And he said, I said, I can sell some of those. And he said, okay. So he gave me a bag of them, and I took them, and I started selling those things in school, and I had all these kids waiting outside these honors classes buying these pills. And, you know, it was very, very bad. I don't know how I didn't get caught, but the teachers liked me. Nobody ever thought I was doing anything wrong. And so then I was then again leading that double life. You know, my one of my heroes was my uncle, and he was a drug dealer, for real drug dealer. He ended up in prison, died in prison, got shot a couple times. He was one of my heroes, too. So I kind of wanted to be like him. I didn't really know why, because I didn't know he was a drug dealer at the time. But anyway, that was me. I was getting straight A's. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing any drugs. I was selling drugs. I liked the whole easy way to get friends, and everything was kind of good. And never really got caught. Things were still pretty calm. But then I guess my dad decided it would be good to move to Georgia. So, just really out of the blue. We never really talked about moving. We just all of a sudden were moving. So I'd, you know, grown up in this community. I was 16 years old, going on 17. I was in my sophomore year. I'd finished my sophomore year. I had straight A's. I was heading for success. I was going to be talking to the Naval, trying to go to the Naval Academy, and was already talking to them. And we moved to Georgia. And I didn't know anybody here. And me and my dad came down here first. In a trailer, which I never understood. We came down here in a camper, and we lived in a trailer park for, like, right off the bat. We'd always had a house and money. I had no idea why we lived in a trailer in the trailer park, but anyway, we had, and so there we were. It was nice. There was nothing wrong with it. And luckily the people were nice. But I started drinking. There wasn't anything to do but drink. And I started working on a framing crew with my dad. He's a home builder, like I said. And so I grew up learning how to be a carpenter, and they put me on a framing crew. And they drank every day, and so I started drinking every day. It's like I went from doing good to not doing good in a weekend. You know, I bought a case of beer as soon as I got to Georgia. You know, I didn't even know what to do with the case of beer. I figured it out. I didn't know anybody here. I didn't have anything to do. I started hanging out with these guys that were 28 years old, been to prison a few times, very rough characters. They had pot. I tried some of that pot. It was really good pot. That was it. I just started drinking and smoking pot and being on a framing crew and getting ready for school. And then we moved the rest of my family down here, and we rented a house, and we just suddenly transplanted to Georgia. And my first day in high school, I was kind of glad to go to school because I didn't know anybody. And so you can't really make. As a teenager, looking back, it's very hard to make friends when you're in your later years of high school. You know, nobody was going to be nice to you. People don't want to talk to you. It just was not easy. Or at least I wasn't good at it. And so when I got into high school, I mean, I made all the wrong friends right off the bat. The guys that were smoking pot, the guys that were, even the guys on the football team that were smoking pot, they were my friends. I had good pot. I could get alcohol. I had a car. I had money. So it was not hard to make friends quickly with the people that like to drink and party. So I went on to, I still got pretty good grades. I was almost done with school, really, in my junior year. I got in that early work release program, and I started just going to work every day with my dad. So I was making a lot of money. I was making more than the teachers were, some of them, and I was letting them know it, and they don't like that. They don't like dealing with a smart-ass kid who, you know, has been stoned all morning, telling them that you make more than them, and just, oh, my God, what a dick I was. Hopefully you didn't record that, but the... Anyway, I was a real jerk to those teachers, but I made it through high school pretty easy because I had already done all the work. I did all the work before I started getting all screwed up. You know, my drinking got exponentially worse. We started drinking every day. We were at a football game, and I haven't been to that high school in 30 years. And I was there with my wife, and I was telling her that I was stoned every day at that school. And she said, "No, you weren't. There's no way you were stoned every day." And I said, "Yeah, I was stoned every day. We smoked pot on the way to school every day." And I thought about it. Am I telling the truth? Because I don't always get my stories right. And, you know, some things I don't remember, and sometimes I exaggerate. And you really, I got to fact check myself and see, was it? But yeah, I did. I stayed stoned in that school almost every day. So I was drinking. I was selling drugs at school. I was getting high with some of the teachers. I was a hit at work. Some of my dad's superintendents, I was selling them drugs. I was drinking whenever I wanted. I had plenty of money and just really hadn't done any hard drugs yet. Drinking was still pretty good. I liked it. I liked drinking. I liked smoking pot. I liked being high. I liked selling stuff to people. I liked the power you had over that. And, I just liked everything that went along with it. It was kind of really, I had way too much money, way too much freedom, not enough consequences, and had no idea the road I was going down. So the idea of being an Air Force pilot went out the window. The idea of going to college went out the window. I thought, I'm making so much money now. Hell, I'll make more money every year. I'll be so rich in 10 years, I won't know what to do. And I guess that's kind of when I figured I'd be dead by 28. I won't pay taxes. I won't file taxes. I'm just going to party just as hard as I can. If everybody was as, you know, if everybody was as serious about partying, we could all party all the time. And I was pretty sure, I tried to tell my mom that 90% of the people in the country drank and did drugs and party like I did. And she looked at me like, first she looked at me like I was stupid. and then I really tried to convince her. And that was really what I thought. I thought 90% of the people. And that really, if we would just try harder, we could just do that all the time, really. We didn't have to stop. You know, you didn't have to stop and go to work. We didn't have to stop and raise the kids. We could just have one big party. You know, how your thinking gets so distorted. But I really believe that shit. So, you know, I made it out of high school. I graduated. We from there, I went and just really started drinking harder and harder and harder. I was a daily drinker. I was drinking over a 12-pack a day, 19 years old, you know, already drinking that much, well over a 12-pack a day, and that's on a regular day. That's kind of every day, and then on the weekends, and just however much money I could get in my hands is how much I drank and partied. And some good friends introduced me to some harder drugs and introduced me to cocaine, and I knew better. I knew I shouldn't do that stuff. I saw the kids that I sold it to. I saw, you know, how whacked out they got. I just didn't think that was how it was going to go for me. So I did that stuff. I loved that stuff. I did as much of that stuff as I could get from the time I did it until I ran out of money. And it just got so bad, and I was so broke all the time, and I'm an alcoholic. And so when you run out of money and you're an alcoholic and you can't buy alcohol or cigarettes or can't go get do anything, you can't put gas in your car. So I was hating it. I mean, those times between paychecks, so long, and trying to work without sleeping is so hard. Even in your 20s, if you stay up partying until 7 in the morning and you try to be at work at 7:30, it's terrible. You can't do it. You know, sitting there thinking, okay, you're watching a clock. Okay, if I go to sleep now, I'll have 2 hours of sleep. Well, that ain't going to work. So if I go to sleep now, I'll have an hour of sleep. So that ain't going to work. Well, if I can just get 15 minutes, I'm sure I can drive to work. You know, and I'm still drunk and high from the night before. I'd show up. I was the boss's son, so no one could say anything to me. You know, and as long as my dad was okay with everything, you know, and in his mind, I was still just drinking. In his mind, as long as you went to work, you didn't have a drinking problem. If you showed up to work, there was no drinking problem. I showed up to work, so there was no drinking problem. I wasn't going to tell him I was doing drugs, and none of his superintendents were going to tell him I was doing drugs, because they were buying them from me. So it was just a bad situation. I'm lucky I lived, really. I'll talk about it a little bit later on, but two of my boys died from this disease. No matter when you throw that in there, that one's hard. So I lost two kids, two stepsons to this disease, partying like I did. So as easy as it can be to talk about sometimes, as funny as some of the stories can be, you know, that's really where I should have ended up, right there. You know, about 25, 26, I was at the end of the rope. You know, it got really, really bad really, really fast. So really everything was a party and everything was good until it went bad. And it was probably 6 months from it going really bad to treatment. So it really wasn't very long. And once it goes bad, it just never gets better. You know, all the fun was gone. I was drinking all the time. My dad got a girlfriend. My mom didn't like that. So she just couldn't understand his way of thinking. And so that ended that marriage, and he moved out, and it was just really a bad time, and I was all screwed up, and nobody to watch me, and way too much money, and the drinking got worse. I got introduced to crack cocaine, which really took things to an all-time low, because I'd never run out of money so fast in my life. You know, I could almost do cocaine for a weekend. Crack would last you 2 or 3 hours, and I was broke. I either had bad dealers or not enough money or whatever. I could never go. You know, I'd head home with a paycheck, and by 2 a.m. I was broke, not knowing what to do, strung out, couldn't drink, sick, hacking up things that different colors and just dry heaves and just my liver was swelling. You know, my friends didn't want to hang out with me anymore. I wasn't allowed to go around a lot of places where people used to love to see me. You know, they didn't want me coming over there. You know, because I was just screwed up, fat. I just kept getting sicker and sicker, and it kept getting worse and worse, and I couldn't get off that stuff, and it was a nightmare. I started seeing things. I started seeing, you know, monsters in the night and stuff like that, and I'd wake up, and they'd still be there, and I'd sleep, and they'd still be there, and I'd drink, and they'd still be there, and I got to where my drinking, my tolerance just got less and less. After a couple of drinks, I'd be blacked out, and after being blacked out, I'd wake up downtown in neighborhoods I should not have been in. You know, and they'd shuffle me around and try and keep the police from finding me. And as soon as I ran out of money, they'd kick me out. And I'd head back home broke and strung out. And that went on for about probably start to finish, maybe 6 months. And then I ended up getting, I was in a hotel room by myself, and I was convulsing. I was like going into convulsions from the drugs I was doing. And I just asked God just to take me, you know, like, please help me, God. You know, it was one of those, that moment of clarity, sincere prayers. And I meant it, you know, and I was like, God, this has to stop. I mean, you got to help me or you got to take me. I just can't do this anymore. And I went to sleep. I woke up the next day, straight back to drinking. It really didn't change a whole lot. You know, God saved me. I just went right back to drinking. But I started going to jail. I started getting locked up a lot, you know. And so I was saying prayers, God, don't let me go downtown again and get on these drugs. And my tire went flat. So I thought, well, God's talking to me. So I got a ride and went down there and got drugs. And whatever happened to stop me from going, I just couldn't see it. And then I was going down. I was driving to Atlanta. I was probably doing about 120 miles an hour, hoping I would hit a bridge, hoping something would happen, hoping I would get arrested. Just wanted it to stop. And the police caught me. You know, they caught me in the wrong neighborhood in my car. And they put me in jail for a DUI. And really, that was kind of like the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, it was my second DUI, and they locked me up, and it put a stop to it. You know, my parents left me in there. They didn't get me right out. It was in Atlanta, and it was scary. I didn't want to be there, but it stopped all that insanity. It just stopped it dead in its tracks. So really, you know, you think going to jail is the worst thing, and I had been to jail 30, 40 times before that. It was really just an intermission between parties. You know, people would pick me up with beer in the car and would take off drinking. But, you know, I was just happy to be arrested. You know, I was happy to be in jail. Somehow I knew that was going to have something to do with something getting different, at least. I had tried drinking, stopping drinking. I had tried stopping drinking probably about 3 months before that. And it lasted about 2 weeks. And I stopped drinking. I wasn't going to drink. And I went out and told everybody I was an alcoholic. And I was not going to drink anymore. And I was done with it. I made sure to notify everybody. I went and told people that didn't give a shit what I had to say. Everybody, people in stores, I don't drink anymore. I'm going to quit. They didn't even know what I was talking about. And about 2 weeks later, I decided I was wrong. That it was okay. It was okay to drink. I had a buddy come in from the Navy, and he'd been in the Navy and gone for about 2-3 years, and he came in from the Navy, and I thought, I just timed this poorly. I'm going to quit drinking after he goes back, because I got to drink with him. And he got here, and I told him what I was doing, told him I wasn't drinking, and he really didn't want me to drink. So I didn't really know what to do there. So I thought, well, he's here. I got to drink with him. So I drank. He thought it was a bad idea. You know, I was going to spend all this time with him drinking while he was here. I got totally annihilated. Never saw him the whole time he was here, and I ended up in jail. So my whole reason for drinking was just out the window. But that was that insanity setting in, you know. I'm going to just drink this one time with my buddy who's here. You know, and I was so sick, I needed to be, you know, in a treatment center. But anyway, the last time in, they made me go to outpatient treatment. They wanted me to go to inpatient treatment. I thought that was too extreme, so I was going to go to outpatient treatment. And I was supposed to go see, my lawyer wanted me to go and get evaluated. So I agreed that I would do that. And they sent me to this guy. And the night before I was supposed to go there, I gave one of my business partners all my money. So I got to go to treatment. I got to do this for court. You got to have my money. You can't not let me have it. You know, don't give me that money back till I go to treatment on Monday. I was beating on his door about 4 hours later trying to get my money back. So, you know, and I'd been drinking and I was going to go downtown. He would not give me my money back, but he did give me a fifth of tequila. And I went home. And it's my last drink. So another drink I remember is my last drink. And so I drank that bottle of tequila getting ready for treatment and all night long. And I went over there in the morning and he's like, when's the last time you had to drink? And I was like, on the way here. And he asked me if I ever did any drugs. I said no. So I thought that would come up in court, so I figured I couldn't tell him I had ever done drugs. And but anyway, that was good enough for him, I guess. And he asked if I could not drink for 24 hours. And I said yes. I don't know where I thought I could, but I said yes, and I did. And they sent me to a doctor, and they put me on antabuse, and then they started the whole outpatient treatment thing. And they sent me to these counseling things to get ready for court and to go to the counseling every day, and I was going to my outpatient treatment, and I learned a lot about alcoholism. And where I always thought you could just stop, and then later in life when you retire, you could just drink like I wanted to, just drink all the time, because I would have money and time on my hands and not a lot to do, and people wouldn't bother me, and I could just drink. It was a lot different with what they had to say about alcoholism. And so, you know, people say you got to get sober for a lot of different reasons. You got to do this, you got to do that. You can't get sober for the judge. You can't get sober for court. I think really whatever stops you from drinking long enough to be able to get something to replace it will work. You know, I came to meetings when I was on antabuse. The only thing that kept me from drinking was the fear of dying from drinking on the antabuse. Or I would have drank. I wanted to drink every day. You know, I thought about it every day until I started working this program. I smoked pot the whole time, you know, when I first started getting sober, I smoked pot to kind of take the edge off. And I come to these meetings, and it's horrible. Smoking pot and come to a meeting and reading the big book and not drinking. That's a recipe for misery. And it was bad. But it took them probably 6 months, or about not 6 months, about 6 weeks to talk me into coming to an AA meeting. And I came here, and I'd listened to what y'all had to say, and I knew I was in the right place, and I knew I was with the right people, and I wanted what y'all had. I got a home group, a sponsor, the whole kit, the white chip, list of numbers. I still have my list of numbers. I don't know what happened to the big book. I never went to the home group meeting, and I never called my sponsor. Like a lot of people start, we don't want to do this stuff. And I came in here, and I had a lot of hope, though. I did come back. I came back to the meetings, and it was hard sitting in the chair, just tapping my feet. I was so nervous, I couldn't sit still. My counselor assured me that you'll know you're getting sober when you start stop tapping the table and shaking the table and your legs stop shaking. You can sit still. And I couldn't hardly hold a cup of coffee. You know, for a long time I had a hard time eating soup because it's hard to keep that stuff in the spoon when you're shaking so bad. And but I was coming here and I was going to the meetings because I had to. And I was not working the program. I did get a sponsor. And then I was talking to him and talking to him and talking to him, and nothing was really, I still wasn't doing anything. So I'm on antabuse. He told me I wasn't allowed to smoke pot anymore. I asked him, could I sell pot? I don't know why I asked him that. And even though that's an outside issue, if anybody asks you, just tell them no. You're not allowed to do that. No, you can't smoke pot. No, you can't sell pot. He told me that. And he told me to go to all the different kinds of meetings and try and find my place in NA and CA. And I went to all the meetings, and I just really felt more home here. Being an alcoholic, this is where I need to be. I can't do any of the other drugs either, but I can't drink. And if I do drink, if I do any of that stuff, I'm going to end up drunk again. But I got so miserable not doing anything, I went out of town to work out of town with a bunch of guys that drank on this framing crew, and I was sitting there, and they were drinking. I was just miserable. I was coming out of my skin. I wanted to drink so bad I couldn't stand it. And I ended up taking a hit off of a bong, really. It was a little bowl of pot. I took one poke off of that thing, and one of the guys there knew something about the program, and he said, now you're going to have to pick up a white chip. I hated that guy so bad. Hated him so bad for saying that. So I didn't do that anymore, and it was just so miserable. It was the most miserable time of my life. But I came back here, and I picked up my last white chip, and I talked to my sponsor, told him I was willing to do whatever it took to get sober. And so about 3 weeks later, I called him up. I wanted to talk about it some more. He said, look, I'm just going to have to fire you. He said, you're not doing anything. You're not coming to my house. I'm not listening to any more of your bullshit. You're just talking about stuff. You're never going to do anything, and you don't really want to get sober. And so I thought, I hung up on him. How dare you talk to me like that? You don't even know who I am. I was so mad. I was ready to punch holes in the wall. And after pitching a fit and storming around my bedroom and hollering at God and hollering at him, I called him back and I said, what do I got to do? So, I was out of options. It was either do what he said to do and have some chance, some small chance of hope of something better happening, or drink. And I knew what that brought, and I just didn't think I would come back. And I thought it would just, that'd be it. And so he told me what to do. He made me get out the big book. He made me do the steps. He made me get in there and read the third step in the 12 and 12, read the 12th, third step in the big book, and get on my knees. And as soon as I was done with that, I was supposed to start writing. And about 6 hours later, I was at his house with my first four step. I wrote all that stuff down. I was heading over there, and it was in ink, and I was wanting to cross some of that stuff out. I thought, surely he's going to ask me what's on that paper. So I can't cross it out because he's going to ask me what it is. And I was like, I may have to kill this guy when I leave, because what am I going to do if he just tells everybody what I have on this paper? And really, my first four step was all the rotten, dirty things I'd ever done in my life written on a piece of paper. Nothing like what the big book says to do. But I took it over there, and we looked at it, and he said, that'll do for now. Let's just say a prayer. We're going to go ahead and light this thing on fire and burn it. It's really of no use to us, and we're going to go on with the rest of the steps. And so we did. We went on with the rest of the steps, and I started making amends. I made my list of people I had to make amends to, and I set out to make these amends. And I was going to do them all in one day. So I set out on my big day and got none of them done. It's like, what the hell? But I guess really it takes a long time. It was over a process of years to make those amends. And I wasn't just supposed to go to people and say, I'm sorry, when there was really not a great chance I was going to stay sober anyway. You know, I just go over there and spit out a bunch of bullshit. But I went through, and each person I kind of came face to face with, and it would just be that horrible sinking feeling that I knew I had to make those amends. And I would make them. The first one was the hardest, and writing all that stuff down and telling somebody all that stuff was my biggest fear. But once I got through that, it was pretty smooth sailing. And I just went on and did everything else that he asked me to do. Got through the steps, and somewhere I was sitting in a meeting, and it just dawned on me that I had not thought about drinking in a week. You know, and I said that out loud in that meeting, and you know, it was just really a good feeling. Not thinking about drinking for a week. If you're in here today and you're not an alcoholic, that really doesn't mean shit. It's really not really that amazing of a thing. But if you're an alcoholic, then you know what I'm talking about. It's an amazing thing not to think about a drink for a day, or a week, or sometimes years. You know, that happens. So the desire to drink left, and I got through the steps, and my sponsor put me to work immediately into the traditions. I had to go through the traditions, and I had to have a home group. He threw a washcloth at me and made me start wiping tables. He threw it right at me. I got very mad. He made me wash the tables. I was like, what do I do? Well, you're going to wash the tables. You're going to clean the ashtrays. You're going to mop up after the meetings. You're going to come here on Saturdays and help work on the house place. You're going to get a home group. You're going to be a member of that home group. And I held all the different service positions you could hold. I became a GSR of the group. About 90 days sober, they talked me into going to a jail meeting. There was about six guys that went. It was a lot of fun. We had a good meeting. The next week, nobody else went. They made me go by myself. I asked my sponsor, should I go? He said, I don't know. I'm going to ask somebody. His name is Pat W. I don't know if anybody knows Pat W. But he kind of started the Howl place. And he said, just go. Go up there with your book. You can't really go wrong. Can't really hurt anybody. And I went up back to that meeting, and I don't know if I did a very good job the first 20 meetings I went to. I was kind of crazy. I was 90 days sober. I didn't know a lot about the program. But I took that book, and I read it, and we did it. And about 3 years later, I was still doing it, you know. And I think one guy in the 3 years came out and said he had gotten sober because I got him a book, and he went on and tried this way of life. And that was it, you know, not really very eventful. One guy in 3 years got sober, you know, but you don't really know who you plant the seed and they go on and get sober later. But the biggest thing was that I stayed sober, you know, and I don't know that I would have stayed sober or really got firmly planted in this program without that, you know. So just that, I was lucky because I was single, I didn't have kids, I didn't have a lot of responsibilities, I still made pretty good money, and I could do everything in AA that it offered. I got sober. The miracle happened. And once it happens, it's not like you're going to miss it. It's not like you're going to have a spiritual awakening. The desire to drink is going to leave. All those promises come true, and you're not going to really know it happened. If you don't know it happened, it didn't happen yet. So And other people will see it before you do, because other people were telling me I was getting it. And I thought they were just trying to egg me on or keep me going, but they were saying that I was getting it before I even knew that I was getting it. And people noticed the change in me. And if you ever looked at people that are sober, you can see the light in their eyes. And if you've seen them when they're drinking and then you see them when they're sober, you can definitely see the light. You can see that whole change, that whole spiritual change. You can actually physically see it in somebody's face. And you can also see it when they stop living this way of life and it goes away and the lights go out. And you know they're out and you know they're going to get drunk. And no matter what you say to them, you can't help them. And they go out and drink. And unfortunately, most don't come back. We only see what happens in these rooms if we stay. So we see people that come back, and we'll see people that leave. But we don't really have a good perspective, but not very high percentage when you go back out after any decent amount of sobriety to come back. You know, most of us. And if we don't work this program, I've had a lot of friends commit suicide. So it took me a long time to realize this, but if you take alcohol away from me, if alcohol is my problem, if I just stop drinking, all my problems will go away. And if I just stay stopped, I won't have any of those problems again. When you take alcohol away from me, I still have problems. I still have a lot of problems. They actually get worse. I have a mental illness. And if I don't treat that mental illness, I'm going to drink again. It's not a question. It's not even a 50-50 shot. There's zero shot. I will drink again in a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. I'm not going to win that fight. And so if I'm coming to the, if I'm refusing to work the program and I'm coming to the meetings and I won't drink and I won't do anything, eventually there's going to be a snapping point. And I've got a lot of friends that have hit that snapping point and it's killed them. You know, they've shot themselves. I've had a lot of friends that, for whatever reason, get on pain medication. Sometimes we have to take pain medication. But for us, it's horribly dangerous. You can't take it lightly. You need help. You got to set up a treatment plan if you're going to be on it for a long period of time. You may have to go in treatment to come off of it. You need to let all your sponsors, all your friends know what you're going to be doing, because I've had a lot of friends get on that stuff for the right reasons. Car accident, surgery, broken back, and they can't ever get off of it. And you know, and then I've had those friends. We're talking 15 or 20 people that have committed suicide because of alcoholism, you know, without drinking. It wasn't the alcohol that killed them. So it's a fatal disease, and I have to treat it. If I go for any amount of time without meetings, I get irritable, restless, and discontent. My life just gets miserable, and I make worse and worse decisions. I know that from experience. You know, I've gone weeks. I guess the longest I've gone without a meeting in 25 years is probably 2 weeks. And when I do that, I get so screwed up in the head. And it always takes probably 3 or 4 months to get back on track. It takes at least 3 or 4 months before I feel good again. And it takes a lot of work to get back on track. It's so much harder to get and stay. And just, it's once you're there and when you're doing these things, it's easy. Just keep doing them. But when you stop, to get back, it's very difficult, even if I don't add alcohol to that. My kids, you know, they died of a heroin overdose. I guess that's an epidemic now. And they drank. And they started early. And I had all these talks with them about what was going to happen to them. I said, I'm an alcoholic. Your mom's an alcoholic. You're going to get, you know, if you drink, you're going to be an alcoholic. If you're going to do these things, you're not going to be able to get off of it. And you know, at 10 years old, they weren't going to do it. At 10 years old, there was no way they were ever going to drink. They listened to me. I was smart. I was their hero. They knew that was going to be true, you know. But at 14, I didn't seem as smart anymore. You know, the knowledge fairy comes in, and the kids get very much smarter, and they get smarter than their parents. And you know, I talked with my oldest boy. We worked together for about a year before he passed away, and talked about getting sober. And he was gonna do it. When I did at 26, and that was his plan. You know, he was going to come to the meetings, he was going to get sober, same age as I did. And I said, you know, the only hitch is you might not make it. How do you stay alive from here to there? You know, and how do you get a real knowledge of your condition and hit a bottom between here and there without it killing you? And, you know, he just didn't make it. It killed him. You know, he got drunk one night, did something he shouldn't have done, and it took his life. My other boy was a straight-out heroin addict. And it just killed him. the stuff they're putting in it these days just killed him. And it was a much different experience. That stuff screwed me up pretty bad, so I've had to get into counseling and get some outside help. We have to do that sometimes. We're running out of time, but, you know, I've had a great life. I've had a life second to none. Built a business, made a ton of money, lost a business, lost a ton of money. I have a failed marriage. I got married early on when I shouldn't have. And, you know, I got a beautiful son out of that deal, and it didn't really work out, but it's okay. You know, I got two great stepkids out of that deal. I watched those little boys grow up. I raised them. You know, we were kind of little kids together. And so that worked. That was good. I went bankrupt in sobriety. That sucks. You don't realize how bad that sucks until you go through it. All the stuff they talk about, you can stay sober through this, you can stay sober through that, you can stay sober through bankruptcy, divorce, loss of money, loss of a kid. That stuff's cool to read when you're getting sober, but when you're 26, you're thinking that's stuff that has happened to other people, and that it's not going to happen to you. But after being sober 25 years, I've experienced a lot of those things, you know. So all the I could never stay sober if this happened, or I could never stay sober if that happened. That shit's got to go. My sponsor told me early on when I was talking a lot of that nonsense. He said that you can stay sober no matter what. Just don't drink no matter what. You're gonna have to work the program for it to be comfortable or to get through a lot of shit. But you can stay sober and you never have to drink again. You do not have to drink again. And I found that to be true. You know, this program, got a beautiful wife today. We have a great marriage. We're both in the program. We've rejoined the Catholic Church that I stayed away from for 20 years. We got great kids. We got a great household. We're very much about God, serving in the community and just doing a lot of stuff. I got a good, wholesome life. I got a good business. My son works with me. I got, you know, just two kids at the house. And I'm able to be present. I'm able to do everything I'm supposed to do. I'm able to take care of my parents. I'm able to, you know, take care of my kids, pay my bills, function in life, no matter what. I'm able to suck it up and go get counseling when I don't want to. I'm able to double up on my meetings. I'm able to go to a men's meeting, which is brand new for me, which is where he talked me into coming to have to speak to you. You know, as soon as I came back to the meetings, it's not that I wasn't going to meetings. I was going to meetings and I just wasn't present. And a lot of bad things happened and I was in a very bad spot. And when I started going to this men's meeting, they put me to work immediately. And they really didn't even know what was wrong with me. I just showed up at their meeting and they put me to work. I've been sober long enough to just go ahead and say yes. And I had so much other stuff I was supposed to do today. But I did not let that deter me from putting AA first and getting sober first and having that. Because I'll leave here today and I don't know. Somebody might get something out of what I said. Maybe not. I don't know. I'll be sober. I'll be happy. I'll be more at peace. And I'll get a lot of relief. And I'll get sometimes a euphoric feeling a little bit. You know, just everything the drugs and alcohol I used to try to get so hard by mixing, matching, trying to put it all together to just get in that right spot that I never could get. It's all filled. I get all that here from God and from AA and from just showing up and doing the shit y'all asked me to do. As silly as it sounds, there's no way that could ever have an effect or that's not going to help anything. But I don't drink. You know, I don't drink. Do a lot of shit. And I'm happy. I'm reasonably happy most of the time. And I rarely think about drinking. And when I do, it just passes. So that's just it. That's my story. And I'm going to stick to it. That's all I got. Thanks,
Carl.